It is my great pleasure to introduce Nikki Clayton and Clive Wilkins, both of whom have traveled from Cambridge, England, not Cambridge over here, to be with us today. Clive is an internationally renowned artist of great breadth. His work spans studio art, performance art, literature, and a novel take on magic. He is artist in residence in the psychology department in Cambridge University, where he collaborates with Nikki Clayton. Nikki is well known for her pioneering work on the cognition of animals in the crow family. Everybody here has certainly heard of or had the pleasure to read her work and her research, which has greatly expanded our knowledge of avian cognition and its possible convergence with primate cognition. What fewer may know is that she's also an expert performance artist. In fact, she is scientist in residence, working on choreographic works inspired by science. And today she and Clive will be offering us a glimpse into their work with a piece titled The Spoon Lecture, Relativity and Anchors in Time. So let's please welcome our speakers.
Good afternoon. It's very nice of you to have us here. It's a real pleasure to be here in Boston. Me, for the first time, but Nikki's been here before.
So this lecture is a novel take on a problem about convergent minds. We're going to ask the question about how different are human and non-human animals at remembering their pasts. And we're going to extend the question to also explore similarities and differences in their ability to imagine the future and plan for it. Now, these two questions about past and future are in fact interrelated, because as human beings, we're constantly flip-flopping between fleeting images of our lives in the past, our here and now in the present, and an anticipated future that is yet to occur.
Indeed, and we're also going to extrapolate this comparative analysis to explore evidence from the arts in order to illuminate the projection of the self in time, a question which we're all particularly interested in. Interestingly, if a mathematician and a physicist were to come together to explore the notion of time, the chances are that their outcomes would probably be fairly closely associated. However, when an artist and a scientist come together, because the two boxes that we inhabit are culturally far apart, so to speak, the chances are that if there are any points of contact at all, they're going to be significant. And I think for both of us, it's a question of learning how to look at the world that we take for granted in new ways. I mean, we have an example of this, because spoons are, in actual fact, a perfect example of what we mean. And we're going to be coming back to the spoon a few times today. In fact, normally in the UK, when we do this effect, we have here, we're on a big box, which Nikki gets into. And I perform the role of the magician just very briefly. And we do something that's a little bit special. But, of course, we couldn't bring the box with us, and immigration rules would mean that we have to wait at airports for hours. So we're going to do this, the same thing that we do in England in a slightly different way, and we're going to use the spoon for it. So the spoon tonight is my long-legged assistant. Can you imagine this? Me being a magician. And if I were a magician like David Copperfield or something like that, I'd have a box in which I would put my long-legged assistant. Oops, maybe. So it actually sort of goes in like this. In fact, what I'm going to need, whilst my assistant's actually in there, is this is how David Copperfield would do it. And when we do this in the UK, at this particular point, Nikki screams. I haven't done it yet, darling. I take the spoon in the box, or the long-legged assistant. She's only got one leg, but look how beautiful that is. And David Copperfield would come along with the sword, perhaps, and do this. In England, I get a round of applause. Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. Because this kind of defies expectation. But more than that,
more presents during screening.
Oh, yeah. but more than that, the spoon defies expectation, because actually, in the next moment, we realize there's somewhere else. We're ready for lunch. Okay, let's consider another example.
Remember what happened. What you remember becomes what happened.
And so it's interesting how experiences work for us. It's an interesting conundrum. Although we all just witnessed the same events, we're probably all processing the information a little bit differently. How could it be any other way? Although many of us don't actually realise this, perhaps. And this may be because memory is, of course, a subjective experience for all of us, even scientists, who are supposed to be so quintessentially exact. We see the subjective experience through our own eyes. So it's not about what we see, it's often about what we thought we saw.
And it's also a shared experience. Despite the individual differences in what we thought we saw and what we thought we remembered, memory also becomes a vehicle we can use to share our experience with others, to compare notes, to question those realities we can't quite be sure we've seen. And it's not just about the thoughts we've had about the past. We do the very same thing when we think about the
future. Now, for the purposes of today, we've actually divided the talk into four parts. It's going to be easy to follow what's going on. Here's the first of them.
We're going to ask the question, what is mental time travel? Well, it's the ability to remember the past and to think about the future and plan accordingly, as we said in the introduction. And it has two fundamental features about it. The first is self. So it's about being the creative self. After all, the thing about remembering kinds of memories, or episodic memories as they're sometimes called, is that we're very much aware of being the owner and the author of the memory. We create them ourselves. And the second is about time. that we're very much aware that sitting or standing, reflecting in the present, we can send our minds back in time to think about the past. And we can also send them forwards to think about the future, what Dan referred to in his talk, I think, as scenario building or storytelling. More about that a bit later. But of course, what this system gives us, this mental time travel, is that it's the door to identity. Because it's not just about us having a subjective experience of the memory, but our individual memories shape who we are. But in truth, we mean future identity, because it's been suggested that memory is actually more about the future than it is about the past. It allows us to create multiple scenarios for what the future should be, in the hope that we'll better be able to predict and prepare for it.
So, mental time travel allows us to conjecture about alternative worlds that would have operated, perhaps had circumstances unfolded differently for us. And it allows us, importantly, of course, to create new ones that may never come to pass, except in our imaginations.
So it reveals two important points about memory, which we're going to approach both scientifically and artistically. The first is that it's a poor sort of memory that only works backwards. As the White Queen so shrewdly remarked to Alice in Lewis Carroll's famous novel.
And the second is that our memories are not simply a fixed repository of the past. Every time we revisit a memory, we may later alter bits of it, shaped by our subjective experience of the current moment, or the ever-present, ever-eternal present. And we've got a little reading that we'd like to give you out of these books, in actual fact, which highlights something of how this works. And this particular scene out of the Mustachio Quartet, the books that we're actually using in this lecture, it has a person talking. In fact, it's an artist who's at their private view. People are assembled, perhaps as we are tonight, except we should be around champagne and stuff, and there'll be lots of paintings around the wall. And the artist comes forward and has been asked to explain something of his work to the assembled group in order that they might understand. And interestingly, the artist, the man who's interested in the visual world, who's interested in perception, who's actually producing work that describes how he thinks and feels about things, who's trying to understand the reality that surrounds all of us, says this. Reliving memories and imagining futures is essential to all of our lives. Yet the very nature of imagination impedes and disorientates those same memories. It diversifies reality to the point where almost nothing can be known unequivocally. As a species, we make use of this to define multiple truths. In so doing, we keep reinventing our own past and anticipating our preferred futures, both collectively and individually. These things all coexist side by side. Are we unique in being able to dream ourselves into imaginary spaces, those places where our spirits would like us to be seen, travelling mentally in time in the direction of our own choosing? I suspect not. Are we the only ones in a turbulent universe to question the ontology of existence? Now there is a question. For me, painting is not about art, or an artifact, or a book in which characters might only appear to exist. It is the encounter between the conscious mind and the worlds it locates in its perception. I've discovered this. If there is time, we are it. Take me apart and learn my constituents, and you'll realize I do not truly exist. Only your prejudice in this moment refuses to allow you to accept the truth of what I say on behalf of all of us. We wonder about ghosts. We all are.
So the second part is about how mental time travel is studied by scientists. And most of you if not all, know that the brain area that's activated during mental time travel, as pictured here, includes various parts of the frontal and temporal and parietal lobes, but a critical area is the hippocampus, the seahorse structured shape you see illustrated on the right. And it lies about 2 inches in from the top of your ear. So if you imagine placing your finger just above your ear on each side and pushing it in 2 inches, then your virtual fingertip would be touching your hippocampus.
Don't try that at home. Probably not a good idea. And as I'm sure many of us know, a destruction of the hippocampus, it not only destroys the ability to remember past events, but crucially, it also seriously damages the ability to plan for any kind of future.
So, one of the most striking examples of this is the case of the eminent English musician Clive Waring, who studied at Clare College, Cambridge. Now, unlike HM, whose hippocampus was damaged to epilepsy, in this case, it was irrevocably damaged as a result of a viral infection. In fact, it was the herpes simplex virus that normally causes an unpleasant but very minor cold sore. But if it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it's seriously bad news. And in consequence, his episodic memory was completely destroyed. And he can barely remember things for more than about 7 seconds, certainly no more than 30. And there are a series of Horizon programmes in the UK, certainly, going with the title, The Man with the 7-Second Memory. Now, without a permanent marker of the past, the interesting thing is that the present doesn't mean the same either, because it has no anchor. It's just a series of thoughts that pass by on the tide and then float away into oblivion. And there are many clips on YouTube, if any of you are interested in learning more details, but allow us to show you a brief snippet. And this was soon after the infection, and he's sitting on a bench chatting to his wife. Note also how he records time, as you can see here, and uses it, the diary, in the absence of memory, to position himself and his thoughts. So it says things like, hurrah, I do live. I'm alive for the very first time. So in short, the present has to be contextualised if it's to be believed.
We love that line. We just love delivering that line. Say it again, it's so good.
The present has to be contextualised if it's to be believed. But more than that, as Clive Waring said himself, and I think this line we like even more, consciousness has to involve me.
Has to involve me. Has to include me, yeah. In fact, if you're interested in learning more about this, Clive's wife, Deborah Waring, has written a very fascinating book which tells the true story of their predicament. It's called Forever Today. But what about animals? Is there any evidence that they can remember the past and plan for the future in the way that we're suggesting here? Let's have a look at this excerpt from a BBC Two, British Broadcasting Corporation, science programme called Inside the Animal Mind. It was a three-episode series that was on TV last year. It was very well received. Nikki appeared in the second one, but she was actually the super contributor, if you don't mind me saying, and she actually wrote the whole of the scripts for all three of them. This is interesting.
There is a common behaviour in the animal world that seems to be about planning for the future. It's called caching. It's what squirrels do in the autumn, hiding nuts in the ground so they can be dug up and eaten over the winter months. But if caching were an Olympic sport, then the corvids would be the gold medalists. Most of them seem to do it, much to the annoyance of the squirrels. And this American corvid, the Clark's Nutcracker, is a cash-in king. Researchers have observed how every year it can store and remember the location of thousands of different seeds. This bird truly is the master of memory. But is this just another example of instinctive behaviour to survive the winter? Or is there something far more complex going on? It's a question that's greatly intrigued Professor Nikki Clayton. She studies Western scrub jays, another American corvid, renowned for its caching behaviour. Nikki wanted to discover whether they could do more than just remember where they'd buried food in the past.
If they can travel back in their mind's eye to think about the past, can they also travel forward in their mind's eye to think about the future? Can they imagine the future, if you like? Can they plan ahead?
To find out, Nikki created an experiment based on a very human annoyance. Waking up to find that breakfast is off the menu. For 6 days, the birds were housed in this aviary, split into three zones. In the middle is the dining room, where the birds were fed during the day, and at either end are the bedrooms, where they were kept at night. But there's a twist. Kept overnight in this bedroom, the birds were served an early breakfast. But kept overnight in this one, they got no breakfast and went hungry until mid-morning. The birds experienced this daily routine for almost a week.
So we give them three lots of experiences of waking up in the hungry room and three lots of experiences of waking up in the room that serves breakfast. But the important point is that the birds themselves didn't know which room they'd end up in on any given day.
But then, Nikki changed the test. She allowed the birds to cache food in the evening, before bedtime. She placed caching trays in both the hungry and breakfast rooms. The question was, where would they choose to store the food? Nikki wanted to know if the birds could use their past experience of the two different rooms and plan for the future, namely, for breakfast time tomorrow. The results left no doubt.
What we found is that the birds cache about 5 times as much in the hungry room as they cache in the breakfast room. They can imagine what they're going to need the following morning when they wake up hungry, so they can solve a problem before it's even happened. So what this experiment shows is that the birds can plan for the future.
So the jays' caching behaviour is far more than mere instinct. They have a grasp of the past, but can also anticipate future need and, crucially, plan for it. This skill is very rare in the animal kingdom, and it's the fourth key ability needed to solve problems.
It's called mental time travel. It's the ability to go backwards and forwards in the mind's eye. So it's about projecting yourself in time to remember the past and to imagine the future.
Okay, and just here you can see the results of the experiment, which seems to confirm everything. Interesting, the experiment design was inspired by spoons. Isn't that right, Nikki?
That's right. It's Endel Tolving's spoon test, and he was the father of episodic memory. And for those of you who don't know Endel, he is Estonian. And so the spoon test was actually inspired by an Estonian story of a little girl. And in the story, she has a dream, and she goes in the dream to a party, and everybody there except her has brought their own spoon with them, so they can enjoy this beautiful chocolate dessert. But the rule is, if you haven't got your own spoon, you can't partake. So she watches everyone else enjoying their chocolate pudding, and she goes home from the party. And the first thing she does is go into the kitchen, open the drawer, and take out a spoon, which she then caches under her pillow. Endell Toulding says she puts it under her pillow, but I'm sorry, that's caching. It's hidden after all. And the idea is that then, should she be invited to another party, she's got a spoon ready that she can take with her. So the idea behind Endell Toulding's test was that this is a test that you could apply in principle to any animal, including humans, but it doesn't necessarily have to require language in order to assess their abilities. So based on a previous experience, in the moment now, you take action, in this case, taking a tool, a spoon, and hiding it or saving it for later, so that you've got it ready, that should there be a future scenario, you've prepared for it, and you've taken action now, in the present, in order for a potential future event that hasn't happened yet. And in fact, that's inspired a number of studies, both the planning for breakfast type experiments, and also a number of tool tasks in primates, including young children. And what's more, we now know that this isn't a trivial ability, because in analogous tests to the ones we've used with jays, one example of which is shown here, where we ask, can children plan where to play, albeit with toys, of course, rather than with nuts. Don't want to run the risk of food allergies, of course. We actually found that children weren't able to...
Do it with worms?
I think that would just struggle with ethical approval, actually. We found that the children weren't able to pass the task until they were 4 years of age.
So, anyway, what methods of inquiry do artists use in their approach to the same kind of topic? Interestingly, the creative process is characterized by the sequencing of ideas and original thoughts. And we can see this demonstrated in the Mustachio Quartet, the books that we're actually using that we're discussing in this lecture.
And we can use extracts from the series of Clive's novels as an exemplar of the strategies that could be of use to us. And perhaps the best method of doing this is to provide a synopsis of the plot and the story, and explore devices that are used to reveal and investigate the mechanism by which sense is made of our subjective experience of thinking.
Yes, it's proven to be a good model to test some ideas about how we do these things. In terms of the plot, just to tell you something very briefly that might kind of explain some essential ingredients, there are four books in the Mustachio Quartet. Each book discusses a different character. Each of these characters is separate in their own book. The book could have been written in such a way that each character had a chapter to themselves in the same bigger book. But no, each one has their own book. And each of these characters moves over, across, and through a mythical city called Walkerpest, and so somewhere in mid-Europe. And in so doing, they come across other characters, accidentally or but by design. And interestingly, just setting something up like this, and having four characters who are kind of existentialist and angst-ridden and wondering about their perception, trying to make sense of the world around them, sets up some very interesting possibilities which might allow us to think more deeply or differently about mental time travel in action. And so just to give you a brief flavour of some of the things that could occur, let's just show you a few things. So here are some of the signifiers of mental time travel as signified in the Mustachio Quartet. Firstly, there's four books, but they can be read in any order, although the order that they're read in, of course, will influence the reader's experience. And indeed, the knowledgeable reader, having read all four books, can then think to themselves, oh my God, what would have happened if I knew that information in a different order or in a different way? And indeed, would I have a different complexion as to the whole story? Would my life seem different? Although it's not about the reader's life, is it? Is it? Secondly, there are choices to be made about concerning what's been discovered, and thereafter what should be remembered. Not just what's been discovered and remembered by the characters in the book, because of course the reader is going to bring their own past experience, their own transferable skills, their own knowledge of the universe and how it possibly works with them. And so they're having to bring this to bear on the situation. Thirdly, so the reader's prior knowledge and their current state of mind causes them to automatically make assumptions and associations about the scenario which exist outside of the novels. Actually, if you're a thinking reader, you start to become aware of how the books are influencing you, quite independently of what's happening in the books. And of course, this is a kind of stimulus response that we have in real life to our real lives. And so when it comes down to it, the narrative causes questions to be raised that lie at the heart of how memory and this thing called mental time travel works. The reader is persuaded to ask questions. The reader is persuaded to ask whether the main characters are similar, if not the same as one another. And this informs issues about identity and perspective taking, if it's done well, in potentially profound ways.
So this algorithm quickly persuades the reader, of course, that these characters may all in fact be the same person. Indeed, the notion that all these realities have been generated by one and the same author leads to some interesting inquiry into the nature of the perceived realities and what it means to be a human being and the way in which we as humans engage in this mental time travel.
However, as I've kind of almost intimated already, I suppose, by recognising these issues, the reader becomes complicit. By recognising the author's role, the reader also recognises their own. How could they not? But we explore this specifically in the books as an issue. In truth, it's the reader who is the synthesis of all the action. It's not the author at all. In fact, the author is no more than the architect, if you like, the architect of an idea. In reading the thing, the reader and themselves become God's all-seeing eye, and therefore take the most elevated position in the whole hierarchy.
So the information provided in the novels is diverse, and it's open to interpretation, causing the reader to have to engage with the books personally, as in life. So the reader becomes a protagonist in the action. They can't simply be a passive observer. What they think is actively encouraged and caused to colour the interpretation of what they read. And we can explore this aspect of mental time travel in the following extract from the Mustachio Quartet.
This is taken out of context, but it'll kind of make sense, I think. Yet further, an awakeful man, aware of time, wears two watches. One watch has stopped, and another is wrong. One is correct twice a day, and the other never is. He sits in a chair facing the wall, whilst thinking of growing a moustache that will look like the hands on the clock before him. His alarm clock has not been set, although it should have been had he remembered. He might have to live forever because of this anomaly. The clock behind him has one hand missing. The remaining one has been bent outwards and points into the room, like an index finger making a circular accusation against him and all before it. Not one clock or watch in this room, or even in the entire building, on the closest analysis, has exactly the same time on its face. No two people see the same reality. They can only choose to agree on aspects of a shared one. The man who is aware of time knows all this, of course. The wallpaper has been hung back to front, placing the entire world into a state of interior around the man, around the room.
So the fourth and final part, what do we learn from this? In other words, how does combining the sciences and the arts provide progress to this endeavour? And we're going to consider three things, namely time, memory and self.
Firstly, let's make ourselves aware of an anomaly in our thinking about time. We, as a species, are out of step with the universe by allowing our thinking to indulge in the supposition that time moves in two directions. Interestingly, the principles of science as represented by the standard model that we've been using for over 100 years now do not preclude the possibility of physical time travelling to the past. Yet, on analysis, it seems to be the case that outside of our perceived structures and thinking patterns, time can in truth only really move in one direction, and that's forward. In a simplistic universe, the notion of unfolding entropy is perhaps the prime proof here. For example, as we all know, there's no way of unbreaking an egg, is there?
Now, the interesting thing is that when we reverse time in the mind's eye, we don't actually play it backwards in a continual fashion. So, unlike when we go forwards in time, in fact, when we're going backwards, we jump back, but then we play our imagining forwards again, not backwards. So it's one thing to say that mental time travel goes backwards and forwards, but actually the retrospective time travelling pattern is in fact quite different from the prospective time travelling pattern, the latter being a gradual unfolding of events into a future that hasn't happened yet, and may never happen, at least in quite the same way as we envisage it now. So no wonder, to steal the earlier phrase of Lewis Carroll, it's a poor sort of memory that only works backwards. So that's some considerations about time and the way in which time intersects with memory. But let's look at another aspect of memory.
Before we do, what's the date today? Anybody know? It's the what? 24th.
Ta-da!
Look at that, it's the 24th on there. And we've used this slide a few times, and this is the first time I think it's ever been used on a proper date. Amazing! We're all in the right place at the right time. It's so good. Anyway, there was another point that we were going to make here, which is simply, why do we assume that our memories are an accurate store or representation of the past?
The reconstructive nature of memory was first discovered psychologically by Sir Frederick Bartlett in the early 1900s. But it's only in the last couple of decades or so that neuroscientists have found evidence of how memories can be changed and reconsolidated each time they are revisited. Hence the importance of acknowledging the role of perspective taking in analysing and interpreting our memories. And our natural propensity as a species to constantly rewrite history to suit our most pressing and present purposes.
A third point for consideration, if there was a third point, perhaps might be the manner, in fact it would be the manner, in which we use objects in the world around us as extensions of ourselves. And how we use other things to position ourselves in space and time. Take the spoon, for example. It's the subject of our lecture, no doubt. But in addition to being a kind of utilitarian item, it's also an extension and a reminder, to me in particular, of all the spoons that I've ever seen and encountered. It abets my mental thinking of the world around me. It's a prompt. These physical things become extensions of our thinking process and allow us to capture different kinds of fleeting moments within our living memories, and ones that we can share with others. We do it individually, but hell, you know, we enculturate ourselves to the point where we actually do this collectively as well.
So that's why memory is a shared subjective experience, and it's one that allows us to converge on ideas concerning society and culture, family status, politics, nationhood. And these issues provide order and patterns for our thinking to our world. Becomes an organisation, and let's see an example of these thinking patterns in action.
Okay, we're going to try and do something a little bit different. This is actually a little bit different. Nikki, I would like you, darling, just to face the wall over there and not turn around and look to see what's going on. Yes, it's a pack of playing cards. You didn't know it was going to be this kind of show, did you? I can tell. I haven't even done anything yet. My dear, look at the playing cards. I would like you to take a playing card, and only you must see it. Nobody else must see it. Say stop any time you like. Say stop. Only you see it. Nobody else sees it. All right. Now this is where you've got this right. Make sure nobody else sees it. Yeah.
Nikki, I want you to try and tell us the card that's been taken by a person in the audience. I won't tell you who it is. It's a free chosen card by somebody who's anonymous to you at this present moment in time. And you know what the card is? You've had a look at it? I want you to have a go at it telepathically informing Nikki as to what that particular card is. Nikki, can you have a go and let me know if she gets it right, because I don't know what the card is. Nikki, have a go at telling us what the card is.
Okay, is it all right if I start with the suit?
Uh-huh, yeah, if you want to do it that way, yeah.
So I'm thinking it's a heart.
Is it a heart? Nope. Okay, no, let's start again. It's not a heart. Nikki, tell us what the card is.
Mm. All right, so I'm still going to... It's still going to be all right if I start with the suit.
Yeah, that's all right.
So, I think it's a club.
Nope. All right, this is really, really difficult. You don't know how difficult this is. Okay. Have a go at telling us the suit. Uh-huh.
I'm still thinking it's a heart.
Is it a heart? No. Okay. Try again. Start again.
All right. I'm going to start with the suit, if that's all right.
That's all right. Yeah. Go for it. That's all right.
So you still want me to go with the suit?
Yeah. That's all right.
Diamond, then.
Is it diamond? She's only got two left anyway, hasn't she?
Yes.
Okay. Right, it's a diamond.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
okay.
That's right, it's a diamond.
So it's a picture card.
Uh-huh.
So it's the Queen of Diamonds.
Is it the Queen of Diamonds? That is so complex. Big hand for Nikki. That is very, very complex. What's actually going on there is beyond the wit of man. Certainly beyond the wit of us, anyway. So
in conclusion, it's... You devil. It's time to reevaluate our notions of memory and how it works and how we can share these subjective experiences with others.
And the process that we've been talking about here is explained extensively and explored much further than we've managed to do in this lecture, or even to suggest in this lecture, in the Mustachio Quartet, which is a series of books which interestingly arose kind of like a phoenix out of our collaborative endeavour together, putting the arts and the sciences together, and it's caused us to invent the thing which we call the captured thought.
So everything becomes a device, in fact, for capturing thoughts. It's what we have to do, we have no other way. Even Clive Waring, with his 7-second memory, was obsessed with capturing the thoughts that will forever evade his passing consciousness. Thank you.